You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show, rated the number one podcast of all time.
Of all time. Make sure you're ready, because this is the podcast where you are guaranteed to learn virtually everything.
Well, this episode is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. And for a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use offer code CALLEN9. This is a good company. It's actually incredibly easy to use. And if there are any listeners out there that use Squarespace, will you send me an example of what you've done on it so I can talk about it on the air? Because I think it's actually a really good company. And I think it's an example of what technology is doing for all of us. It's making it cheaper for all of us to, you know, run a business or just create a presence on the web. And I love that. And I think it's actually an excellent company. And they're always updating their platform. And it starts at $8 a month and includes a free domain name and if you sign up for a year. So, and every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website. So your content will look great on any device every time. It's pretty fantastic. So just remember to go to squarespace.com and use the offer code CALLEN9. All right, this is the Brian Callen Show, parentheses Hunter Motz, special guest and permanent guest Hunter Motz, who makes this thing better. Very quickly, because I know America is clamoring for it, I'm going to be at Donnie B's October 3rd and 4th and 5th. I'm doing stand-up in Springfield, Illinois. Run, they're selling out. And then October 11th and 12th and 13th, I'm at the Houston Improv. And then, as if that's not enough, the kid doesn't stop, and they call me the kid because I have tight-fitting skin. October 17th, 18th, and 19th, I'll be at Helium in Buffalo, New York. It's beautiful in Buffalo in October. Without further ado, and I'm going to have Hunter ring her in and read all of her. We have a real live poet on the Brian Callen / Hunter Motz show. Kim Dower, welcome.
Oh, welcome. I was just making my reservations for Buffalo on online.
Damn. Between verses. I hope I'm a muse for you after this and you jot off some poems.
Oh, you're already a muse. Yeah. And amusing and every other kind of muse. But honestly, I think Illinois to Houston to Buffalo, there's a poem there. And I'm going to get on that right away. But
oh, God. It's called Airports and Bad Food.
Yeah, really. But it's a pleasure to be with you, gentlemen. And
well, I want to have, before you know, you start going, I want to have Hunter read off. Give us an introduction of Kim, because you know, most of the people that listen to this, if they're like me, they don't know jack all about poetry. And you know, poetry is one of those luxuries. You think of poetry as like, well, I'm going to now withdraw and write my poetry, everyone. and it feels so outdated in this world, but I think we stay alive for it, and I'm going to make an argument for it, and I know you will too. So Hunter, give us who we're talking to here.
Well, as living poets go, it doesn't get much better than Kim Dower.
Jeez.
Kim is, you know, her poetry was described by the Los Angeles Times as sensual and evocative, lyrical snapshots of life's bittersweet moments, seamlessly combining humor and heartache. You know, she's been the finalist for the Rattle Poetry Prize twice.
The Rattle Poetry Prize?
Well, I mean, that's the thing, right? You know, there are prizes in poetry that poets fight really hard for and we've never heard
it's
of.
It's so funny. I know. There's a whole world out there.
Yeah.
So, I'm a three-time finalist with the Rattle. I don't even know what to say. All right, keep going.
The Rattle Poetry
Prize. Keep going.
I just thought, you know, I thought it would be really interesting to get Kim on because she just wrote this really great article in Publishers Weekly, basically about what has happened to poetry.
Well, I want to talk about that, Kim. Let me start with saying that I became an actor because I, as a young man, I got into Springsteen's poetry, not even his music, and I'd never really been exposed to, you know, you had sonnets and stuff like that, Shakespeare and all that crap you have to sit through in school. But when I started reading the words of Springsteen's poetry, I'm not being dramatic here, not only did it change the course I took in my life, because I chose to be a quote-unquote an artist of some kind, an actor. I just had never... I took that stuff so seriously. I had an old girlfriend who said, when you listen to Springsteen, you go off into this whole moody world, and I can't reach you. And I'd always be like, that's because nothing else matters. You know, and it really was the first time I was ever floored by the power of words. And by the way, the French movie starring Gérard Depardieu, Cyrano de Bergerac, some of the wording in that, the translation from French, is also about as romantic and powerful as it gets. When you read Nabokov or you read Blood Meridian, this isn't so much poetry, but when you get a sense of the power of words and what people who have a command of the English language or any language can do to you, that's kind of what we stay alive for. And I also listen to music where the actual artist isn't, you know, isn't about tricks and hooks. They're telling a story, and if they can do it poetically, forget it. And obviously, Dylan being one of the giants in that particular mode.
Well, you know, I would agree with everything you're saying. The power of words is, there's nothing better. I guess music, when you listen to music, you can be taken into a different world. But that's what poetry, good poetry, will do, because it's also musical. I mean, Bob Dylan to me writes poetry. You know, Bruce Springsteen, I love his lyrics. I never really thought of him as a poet, because the words really need to work with the music.
Yeah.
For me. But listen, you take your poetry where you get it, and that's the thing.
My feeling, my guess is that, you know, you have to cultivate taste for poetry, and it's kind of like, you know, it's like jazz. To know the difference between great jazz and just okay jazz requires investigation and time in the medium. You got to learn about the music before you can actually be an educated critic or somebody who truly gets the most out of it.
An aficionado.
Right.
Aficionado.
Well, you know, it's too bad the way they teach poetry in school. I mean, I think it's changing, but we used to have to read sort of stuffy poems, and we had to interpret them and go through all these paces to quote understand them. Poetry should be fun. It should let you in. It should embrace you and sort of take you into another little world. Good poetry does that. You know, it's there's a great quote from a poet named W. H. Auden, which is one of my favorite quotes. Poetry is the clear expression of mixed feelings.
The clear expression of mixed feelings.
Yeah. That's pretty fucking awesome.
I guess who's stealing that?
I love that. Don't you love that?
Yeah. Brian Callen's comedy is the clear expression of mixed feelings.
Guess what's going on my t-shirts.
Let me tell you something, Brian. A comedy, really good stand-up, is poetry. Because it's the same thing. It's very, you have to be very concise.
Yeah.
And you also, the great stand-up comics and great comedy in general, it looks at a very normal everyday thing. You know, the smallest, most inane object has meaning.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And what poets try to do and comics is take a look at that closer meaning. I mean, Stephen Wright, there's a lot of great stand-up. George Carlin was a poet.
Absolutely.
I mean, he could just riff on one word, and, you know, his whole thing about the difference between baseball and football. Remember that routine?
Yeah, I do.
That's poetry. It's looking at something that everyone, we all see every day, but the poet, the comic, the person who can use words will see it differently and show it to us in a different way.
Well, there's also something called rhythm in poetry and in comedy, and you spend so much time with bits when you're doing comedy, working out the exact structure of the words so that so the payoff and the rhythm is, you know, it is, I guess you get to you distill to the essence of the joke and the truth of the joke, you know?
Well, exactly. And I'm glad you brought up comedy. I mean, I know we're laughing about it, but the truth is they are really cousins. To me, they are. And, you know, I'll tell you something interesting, but Dennis Leary, who, you know, we all know is the actor.
I know Dennis, yeah.
Okay, so Dennis, you know, I taught at Emerson College years ago. Actually, Dennis Leary was in a class I taught, Introduction to Creative Writing. He was a young kid.
Wow.
And Dennis later stayed at Emerson, and he was a really good poet, a really good young poet, and he stayed on, and the head of the English department there was a great guy, James Randall, let Dennis start the comedy writing workshops at Emerson.
Wow. I gotta get Dennis on the podcast and talk to him about that.
I mean, you can ask him about it and ask him about me, and he'll, you know, remember those days when we used to write poems. And the thing is with Dennis, he taught comedy, but timing, here's what it is. It's looking at something and describing it and seeing it differently, making it funny, timing, words, concise words. And, that's what a great comic does.
Yep, that's right. I saw his first show ever, No Cure for Cancer. That's I mean, I've known Dennis forever. You know, it was, I saw that in 1991.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, and he was always such a, you know, he still is kind of like, you know, it's not like you think of Dennis. Oh, Dennis Leary, poetry. You know, it's
yeah,
not,
exactly.
It's not,
well,
right?
No, but I mean, poetry can be very edgy.
Yeah,
and
mm-hmm.
you know,
and he's a writer, by the way. He wrote a lot of that. I mean, he and I can't remember who it was, Tim Nolan, I think. They wrote Rescue Me. I mean, he spent mm-hmm. a lot of time. He's a writer. I mean, he spent a lot of time working out, you know, everything that we're talking about.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. He's a good writer. And there's another quote. You like that one. I'll give you this one. There's another great poet named John Berryman.
Mm-hmm.
And now this reminds me a little of comedy, too, but a good poem should terrify and comfort.
Mm. Yeah.
So that's kind of what we're going for. You know, we're going for mixing all kinds of senses and doing it through words and sounds, but bringing people in, just like comics do, giving a situation that we all know of and then turning it on its side.
Well, one time I was on the subway in New York, and I remember it was just dog days of summer, and I think I was temping and hating my life, and I looked down at my wrists, and my wrists were sweating, and I was in a shirt and tie, and I was like, this can't be my life. I want to be an actor, and I'm running coffee, and it was just a disaster. I was living in Hoboken over a Chinese restaurant, and I looked up, and for a while on the subways they had poetry. They had these short poems.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I think it was... E.E. White or Cummings, I think it was
E.E. Cummings.
Cummings. Listen to me, like some of the giants. I'm like, there was some guy. And here was the poem, and I don't know if it's the whole poem, but it was, I remember I looked up and it said, "From the tables of joy, a crumb falls. Sometimes a bone is flung. For some there is love, for others only heaven." And just those four lines made me so profoundly sad, but at the same time, so. Joyous at the notion that life is so so mixed mm-hmm. and so complicated and so beautiful, and so that idea of, I think Karen Armstrong, who wrote a book called The Case for God, and she was describing religion as you don't forget that religion is also inspiring and religion is also about mystery, and she compared it to a great, you know, Beethoven sonata or Mozart sonata, saying, you know, you can listen to music that makes you feel profoundly joyous and profoundly sad at the same time.
Yeah, I think that's a mix that we look for in life.
We
know?
Do look for it. It makes us feel more alive, and that's kind of where poetry, I think, it really plays its role.
Yeah, and there was one other one I remember, because you guys had it on the subways in New York or whatever. We had it on billboards. It was the same, Poetry in Motion is what it was called.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And one of my favorite poets, James Tate, there was a line that was on the billboard up on Sunset, and it said, "You are the stranger who gets stranger by the hour."
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of haikus that I love. Like one is, "Even with insects, some can sing and some cannot."
Uh-huh. Beautiful.
Yeah, and that economy of words that packs a punch that makes you feel is, I think, I would argue what we stay alive for. I'm not interested in living in a world just of math and just biology. I think that was where, that's where the romantics and where romance plays a part. What the hell would we do without people who just create beauty for beauty's sake? There's nothing rational about poetry. I mean, in a way, what I mean is just the idea that you sit around in a room trying to create beauty. It's amazing.
Well, you know, I'll just say, Brian, it's more than beauty is a nice part of it, but it's also connection, and it's you know, connecting with people by showing them a little about life that they may not have thought about, or looking at something in a way they never thought of.
Mm-hmm.
Not always beautiful, mm-hmm. unfortunately.
Oh,
but,
no, you're right.
But
I mean, spoken word, you hear a lot of spoken word. You know, and I don't know what you consider spoken word, whether you can say that's poetry or whatnot. I know Henry Rollins said, "I'm not a poet, I'm a spoken word," you know.
Yeah.
But it I've heard some amazing spoken word that is pretty darn powerful.
Yeah, and absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, I think one of the things that's really interesting, right? You describe comedy and poetry as cousins, right? And that's certainly an idea that the Greeks held, right? The nine muses, right? They're all very much within the same family. But poetry has, in the last 50 or 60 years, become the redheaded stepchild of that family, you know? It's become marginalized, and it's not, I mean, you know, comedy remains mainstream. Many of these things remain mainstream. Well, you know, your article that you wrote in Publishers Weekly is, I think, so great, and I think begins to unlock why that is. Would you mind telling us a little bit about that?
Well, I had an idea that I realized more and more people think that poetry is autobiographical. They think that you're always telling the story of your life. So, you know, you go to poetry workshops and you read a poem out loud and the people say, oh, well, when did that happen to you? Or, you know, and it's not about you. A poem is made up just like a fiction is made up. And so it's really interesting to me. And my first book was lucky enough to get on the bestseller list at Book Soup. I had done a reading there, etc., and the store in Los Angeles.
Yeah, great store, by the way.
It's a great store, and I saw it on the bestseller list, and I was so excited, but then I realized it was on the nonfiction list.
Mm.
And it hit me that not only do people think poems are autobiographical, but even stores put them in nonfiction. So the world thinks, you know, that poetry is all based on fact. And I thought that was really interesting, so I wrote this piece about that, you know, asking, did Robert Frost really stop by the woods on a snowy evening? I mean, you know, I mean, maybe he didn't, maybe he didn't. But the idea is that the poems come from something maybe you see or think of or hear.
Metaphor.
Yeah. Metaphor, but then you take a ride with it. You know, mm-hmm. Then you start lying your head off, and poems are, you know, not necessarily true.
And I think that's part of, you know, you're saying that poetry is supposed to be about connection, but so much of it has become inward. You know what I mean? In the last 50, 60 years, it has really become about the poet talking to themselves rather than really coming from a place of trying to connect with the audience and trying to create an experience in the reader. And that's part of what I love about your poetry so much is it's clear that you really want to reach the reader and have an effect on the reader.
Yeah, we're going to have you read some of that. But I think there's another issue with poetry is that it's just that, you know, there's no time in people's minds in some ways. Like the idea that because poetry, becoming a good poet, you need a lot of time just to work on, you know, when you see when you read a great poem, there's no doubt that, I mean, with a rare exception, that takes I can just, you know, just as a comic, I know that takes a long time.
Right.
I mean, that takes a lot of effort and thought and inspiration and all that stuff. And so, in some ways, it's like when you Springsteen took 9 months to write Born to Run. Well, you know, what? Well, it was a story. He was trying to get it all just exactly right. I mean, it took him forever to get those songs. I think Born to Run took him 6 months. The actual song took him 6 months, and the entire album, just he kept going back. And I'm using him as, I don't mean to put him in, but just the economy of words and getting it just the way you feel is the truth, the distillation of what it, you know, I love the idea that the poem exists already and it's up to you to keep channeling, you know, it's in the sky somewhere and you're the frequency and you kind of just keep channeling, keep showing up at your desk until it kind of reveals itself. I've always loved that idea of, I think of writing that way, but.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Now, where did you hear that? Because
Flannery O'Connor, it started with Flannery O'Connor saying, there are two stories that that hit me profoundly. Flannery O'Connor once said, I sit at my typewriter at 5:30 in the morning, not to write, but in case something happens.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen Pressfield in his book, The War for Art, says the same thing, but he's a bit derivative in you know, where this guy who won the Fields Medal in mathematics, which comes, I think, with a $1 million prize, it's kind of the Nobel Prize for mathematics, that he refused the prize. And in fact, they found him in Siberia working on another equation. I think the answer was 357 pages long. They didn't even know if the question existed. And he said, not only does it exist, but here's the answer. And all these mathematicians were like, wow, the great genius of math. And he said, I don't want this prize, but you give it to the equation. You're giving it to me. It's like giving the prize to the radio as opposed to the music. He said, I just happen to have a certain type of wiring that you know, was able to channel that great equation that in the template in the sky. And a lot of mathematicians talk that way. Mm-hmm. Even Springsteen, I talked to him about writing music, and he said, you know, I start with a metaphor. You just sit there until something comes up and shows itself. That's my Springsteen personal.
Oh, that was very good. Thank you. For a minute, I thought he was on the line with us.
Thank you. You know what? Isn't that amazing? Talk about talent. I can seamlessly
Brian,
slip in there.
You're just flooring me.
Channeled Springsteen.
I channeled a Jersey accent.
Well, I want to say I love that book, The War of Art, by the way. It's a great book. But, you know, Anne Sexton, who is one of our mm-hmm. great poets, and she is, as a matter of fact, from the School of Confessional Poetry. So she was, you know, telling things from her soul. But she would say that the poems came from God, mm-hmm. you know, that she would sit there. And I think that there's something, I mean, often I sit down and I just write a line, and then it just takes off. You don't really know where it's going to go. But you have to get to the point where you can give yourself up for grabs.
I was going to say, you know, what you're talking about is I think writing poetry is a humbling process. You know, when you give yourself up like that, when you surrender, and you just said it, giving yourself up for grabs, that's a form of surrender, you know.
Well, it's also trust. You know, when people talk about writer's block or they're not in the zone yet. If you're going to have writer's block, there's no reason for anyone to force themselves to write. You know, I don't sit down like people say and, oh, you have to do it 20 minutes then and 20 minutes. I sit down, it just flows out. But that took a long time to get to that point because, in a way, I don't care anymore. Mm. It's either going to come out or it's not. And it's a beautiful, when I'm in the zone, nothing else matters, truly. Mm. Now, that's not saying I get up and a poem has been created. That's what you're talking about then, what you said before. Then it's, you know, hours and weeks of crafting it and getting rid of that word and reading it out loud and is it musical and are you saying what you think you want to say. And, you know, that's the wrestling part. Mm. You know, and then when you're done, you're done. Then it doesn't belong to you anymore. The poems in this book, in my first book, I don't even remember writing them. They're gone. They're out of my hands. And it's all about whatever idea I have today. So I think that it can be a really beautiful process for the poet if you don't take it so seriously. And I know that that sounds the opposite of what I should say, but writing poetry is not serious. It's crafting it after it's down and trying to mold it and get it perfect. That's more serious.
Yeah. It's mm-hmm. the same thing with writing. I mean, there's no such thing as a book or a script that's been written in just one draft. I mean, give me a break. The inspiration hits and then you go back over it and that's where the real...
And try and understand what it was you just did.
Yeah.
And what can make it more what it's supposed to be.
And then also, you know, just going back to what Hunter said before, that is the poem for you or is the poem for others? You know, the question is, do you write for yourself or do you write for an audience? I think that's an important question, and your listeners who are writers, you know, we all think about this. Who are you writing for? And when you first sit down, you're writing for what comes out of you. Mm. You know, that's what's coming out of you, and an emotion could really trigger that, you know, a death or losing a lover or, you know, any strong emotional situation will trigger a poem or a song or a routine for a comic, what have you. And that's the writing for yourself part. But then when it's down and you're going to actually get it into the world, then it shifts. And then I believe you're writing for an audience because no one cares about your little experience and your little feeling.
Yeah.
No one cares if someone hurt your feelings or what's... Then you turn it into, and for all the poets who might not like this word, entertainment. I mean, then it's who's going to connect with this? Is this situation too close to my own heart to let anyone in? Mm. You know, so you have to see who are you speaking to and how can you reach them?
Yeah, it's interesting. I guess stand-up is the same way. Like I start by writing sort of what is my truth? Like what am I going through? Like what am I afraid of? What am I... I always say to writers, you know, stand-up, well, you got any advice? Because I'm now older and people come, you know. And I say, I don't know, man. I don't have advice. I just know you got to write every day and try to perform as much. But I would say that if you try not to... It's not about being funny. Initially, try to write about what you're ashamed of, what you're scared of, who you want to be versus who you really are. That's where the meat lies. That's where the fun lies. And if you start mining... Them Thar Hills, man, you can find some gold. Notice how I just went into a southern. That was a western.
That was good. That was. I didn't know if it was going to be Bruce for a minute.
No.
Southern. Okay.
That was a 1890s coal miner or gold digger, whatever the hell you call it.
All right, Brian, we're losing you now.
We're going down into the mines.
But I just want to say to that what the material you're mining is a comic. The things that you're ashamed of or feel, all of these things are connectors. It's what I call, you know, connector. I don't know why I decide I've called it that, but suddenly it's what I call it.
This is your podcast, damn it.
Okay, beautiful. So I'm declaring it.
Take it, sister.
I'm declaring it. But that's how you connect, because that's how people relate to you. But then how can you take, as a comic and or a poet, you look at those things, and how can you get rid of the cliches, because we all have similar, you know, things about what shames us, et cetera, et cetera. But how can you make that funny? How can you make a spin on that?
Mm-hmm.
So there we are.
Yeah. And I think the other thing that's really interesting is, you know, you use the phrase in the zone when talking about that writing experience.
Yeah.
That's, of course, you know, what Mihai Csikszentmihalyi calls flow. Right, that's
yes.
the experience.
Say
of
that name again.
Mihai Csikszentmihalyi.
God.
It took me a long ass time.
He wrote that book on what?
Flow.
Yeah, it's called Flow. Yeah,
I read that. Flow. I mean, that's absolutely it. And I actually like the flow concept better than the in the zone concept, because that sounds really stuck, like in this little box, this groove in the zone. But in the flow, it's the ideas are just coming out, and you can't stop them or edit them or censor them. Just let them out. And then deal with them. Then look at them.
Do you think that there is a? Do you think that I read it, and I think it was Harper's said, you know, the problem with magazines now is it used to be that Harper's could run an article on the opera scene, or the modern art scene in New York, and the housewife in Toledo would read it. Because there was, in the 70s, there was this notion that you would reach beyond yourself. I mean, it wasn't about yourself. Now magazines are all about niche appetites. You know, this is all about you. What's the best way to eat, the best way to dress? We had a guy, Dan Robinson, who's a professor at Oxford, say, architecture in the past 20 years, you know, these grand structures are about the architect. You know, if you don't know who these great Gothic cathedrals in Europe, there was really never even a plaque to the actual architect, because it was being done for something much bigger than himself. Do you think do you think there's any truth to that in today's world, or is that just because we're all getting a little older and we're looking at these damn kids?
No, I think it's the most narcissistic world we've ever been in. It's frightening. Mm. I mean, look at Facebook and all, and tweets, and it's revolting. I mean, I'm sorry. I know that I don't get a lot of it, but the amount of energy that's spent by people just talking about themselves,
I agree,
and
100%.
What they do, is just unbelievable. Now, you know, with everything, you can find good things in this material, but no, it's just overwhelming. Everyone has an opinion, and who cares?
I agree.
You know, I don't know.
That's why I'm always, if I ever tweet, because I have to as a comic, it's always something, at least I'm trying to make you laugh. I'm not telling you how great these sandwiches are at this ridiculous place that I'm eating at. Sean Puffy Combs talking, I mean, read his tweets. You're like, dude, you are not a historically important human being. You got to stop.
Yeah, I know. It's amazing.
I mean,
but, you know, I write a lot of my poems. This book, Slice of Moon, every poem in the book, and I didn't plan it, every poem in the book has food in it. I mean, Hunter understands my my whatever obsession with food, but I would rather write about food in a poem than tweet about some sandwich that I just ate at a deli. Like, who really wants to know how much fat was on the pastrami that I had? Is there anyone? At the same time, there's something fascinating about looking at these things that people talk about, you know, the food. I'm watching out my window. I'm about to get a ticket. And see, there's a poem in this, you know, like being on a live radio show, watching yourself get a ticket, and I can't yell out a word that I can't say.
No, do it.
A word that I can't say on the radio
no,
right
bullshit
now.
Bullshit, you can. Do it. We swear on this program.
I don't want to say anything bad.
Hold the phone up. Hey, you bastard!
But yeah, well, there's a kind word, but anyway.
She's a poet, you son of a bitch!
It's like, why me, why
I
now?
I break
but
for poets.
Anyway.
Poets aren't getting paid.
Really, I can't afford this. Anyway, there he is, and fine, I just have to live with it. But
you could write a poem on the back of the ticket and, like, mail it in. You know, dear city
of
LA.
I totally could.
Floor him with your metaphors.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, there's a poem in that. There's a poem in everything, you know, that's the point.
How often do you write poetry?
Every day.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, I don't finish a poem every day, but I write a little every day. Hmm. You know, I mean, now it's become, I guess, the way working out used to be. But, you know, if you don't do it every day, you feel kind of sick. And so, I mean, I'll write something now and again. I have, I'm watching this girl argue with the guy who's giving her a ticket now. Anyway,
there's a poem in that too.
There's a poem in that too. And
well, this episode is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. And for a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use offer code Callen9. Do you have a favorite poet?
Oh gosh, I have several favorites, but.
Is there one poem that you just can't shake, that floored you, that changed your life, that I don't know?
Oh, wow. Well, I'll tell you, I have a strange combination of favorites, but one of them is Frank O'Hara. I don't know if you've ever heard of Frank O'Hara, but he's what we call from the New York School of Poets, and he wrote in the 50s and 60s in New York, and he was very conversational. He wrote the poem "The Day Lady Died," which was
about Billie Holiday.
Yeah, about Billie Holiday, yeah. And it's just.
I'd like to hear that.
His poems were like. Somebody once said his poems were like having a phone conversation with him. Yeah. They were just very matter of fact, and I think I try to do that in some of my poems. Mm. And then I also love William Carlos Williams, who's kind of the opposite of Frank O'Hara. William Carlos Williams is the poet who said no ideas but in things. And you know, he wrote the famous thing that was crammed down our throats, unfortunately not in a way that we loved, but a red wheelbarrow, you know, so much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens. And it's a very simple poem, but when you think about it, what depends on it, our whole life depends on our ability to see that. So that's one of my favorite poems. And
I'm going to read this, The Day Lady Died here by Frank O'Hara for a second. This is when Billie Holiday died. And if any of you guys listening don't know Billie Holiday, then get her music, because I mean, you know, she was one of those, you know, her history is I think when she was 13, her mother was going to be thrown out of her house, and they couldn't pay the rent in Harlem in the middle of winter, and she went out and sang at all these speakeasies. And she knew she had something because everybody was crying into their beer and throwing money at her. And she picked up like $13, $14 that night, which was a fortune back then. And she was like, I think I got something here. But if you ever hear her, she got into drugs and everything else. But her diary and stuff, she was just something. She's got if you ever want to hear a song that'll haunt you and chill you to your bones, Strange Fruit. She sings Strange Fruit. Strange Fruit is a black man hanging from a tree in the South. And it's a very eerie poem, and the guy who plays the trumpet, and I think it's off of Lady Sings the Blues, is it's in some ways it's maybe the greatest song, at least that one of the more powerful songs ever written, I think, especially the way she sings it. But anyway, the Day Lady Died, this is by Frank O'Hara. It's 12:20 in New York, a Friday, 3 days after Bastille Day. Yes, it is 1959, and I go get a shoe shine because I will get off the 419 in East Hampton at 7:15 and then go straight to dinner, and I don't know the people who will feed me. I wake up the muggy street beginning to sun and have a hamburger and a malted and buy an ugly New World writing to see what the poets in Ghana are doing these days. I go on the bank, and Miss Stillwagon, first name Linda I once heard, doesn't even look up at my balance for once in her life. And in the Golden Griffin, I get a little Verlaine for Patsy with drawings by Bonnard, although I do think of Hesiod, trans. Richard Lattimore or Brenda Behan's new play, or Le Balcon, or Les Negres of Genet or Genet. But I don't. I stick with Verlaine after practically going to sleep with quandariness. And for Mike, I just stroll into the Park Lane liquor store and ask for a bottle of Strega, and then I go back where I came from to 6th Avenue and the tobacconist in the Ziegfeld Theater and casually ask for a carton of Galois and a carton of Picayunes and a New York Post with her face on it. And I am sweating a lot by now and thinking of leaning on the John Doerr in the 5 spot while she whispered a song along the keyboard to Mal Waldron and everyone, and I stopped breathing. I did a bad job reading that, but that's a beautiful poem.
It's a great poem, and the thing about it and what I've always been attracted to by all his work is it's sort of a casual, that's what I was talking about. You bring the reader in. It's just a regular day. He's going about his business. It's the day Lady died, and he's just running his errands, and he's going to go out and have dinner with people, and he doesn't know who they are, and he goes to the bank, and Linda, he once heard her name was. But it hits you like just a punch in the face, the New York Post. I mean, of course, in those days, we got our news from newspapers and headlines, and the New York Post had those big black block headlines, and there it was, and he, you know, almost throws up when he sees it. And we're with him as he's walking down the hot, muggy street on 6th Avenue in New York. We're with him finding out how he felt the day that she died. So, I mean, that poem, as simple as it is, it seems simple. There's volumes written about that poem and
really?
Why it works the way it works. Yeah, if you Google The Day Lady Died, Frank O'Hara, you'll see, you know, 40 essays. I mean, so it looks simple. What we love is when something looks simple and it just follows us forever.
Well, I realized when I was reading it, I realized that this poem probably has to be read in a certain way as well. You can't just look at it and cold read it, because there feels like there's a rhythm, and there feels like there's, you know, there's, he was writing, like you said, this would be something an actor could actually do as a monologue.
Well, yeah, I mean, absolutely. And a lot of poets kind of destroy their own work because they can't read it. You know, I love to hear, I did this show last night, this guy Dennis Morton, the poetry show, and listening to him read my poems, I was like, geez, who wrote that?
I wrote a play one time, and the actors were so bad, and I was just like, that's not the way to do it, man. They just butchered it. But then when you have somebody who can really do it, it's amazing.
Yeah, it sounded beautiful. So, yeah.
Well, how about you read one of your favorite poems?
Well, I don't know. Hunter, do you have a poem of mine that you want, would you like me to read, or...
Well, it's up to you. I mean, you know, that I'm very partial to one poem in particular, but I think, yeah, I mean, do you want to pick something from Slice of Moon or Air Kissing on Mars?
You guys have a whole thing going on.
Yeah, there is, you know.
We have a whole thing going on. Well, you know, I pulled out that 13 Knishes. I don't know if you want that.
I think it's pretty great. I would love that poem.
You know, I give a little backstory. Does Brian know that we go way back here? Or
I mean,
I don't,
he's
but
just
I'm,
finding out,
I
really.
I can't wait to read the poems about Hunter Motz.
Well, what's interesting, okay, so this is not in Slice of Moon, and also this is a very new poem. I may go in there some more with this poem, but this was just came up from a very simple thing, but Hunter, well, I'll just read the poem, all right?
Okay.
It's called 13 Knishes.
And now explain to everybody what a knish is for those people who are not New Yorkers, not Jewish, and all that
oh,
stuff.
Oh, gosh. You know, well, Hunter didn't even know what a knish was, so there we go.
Come on, Hunter.
Well, knish is how do you explain it? They come in meat or potato or kasha, and they're like fried with dough, and they're very, very heavy, okay?
Yeah.
Let's just say if you have 2 bites of a knish and you don't weigh more than 130 pounds, you're done for the day.
There
yeah,
it is.
And
all
the,
right.
the story is that Kim texted me, and, you know, I said I was in Brighton Beach, and she said that she had memories of Brighton Beach going out there and getting a knish on the way. Now, I thought a knish was like a small little dumpling thing,
you
right?
Wasp.
Yeah.
You're such a wasp.
So I called up this place. I asked a friend of mine who's getting his PhD in history, but specifically Jewish history, what's the best knish place in New York? He said, oh, there's this place on the Lower East Side or whatever. So I call them up and I say, can you set aside a dozen knishes for me? Thinking it's like a small thing
oh
of dumplings.
God.
And they're like, well, if you get a dozen, you get a 13th free. And I was like, great.
So it got us through our history. Every time there was a pogrom, we'd pack our caniches, for God's sake.
Can you imagine the recipient of 13 caniches?
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so I didn't even know what to do when he walked in because it was very sweet, you know, and I picked, and it was like holding a bowling ball. I almost felt,
13 so, bowling balls.
You know, and I just, now this is something that inspired me. Now, let me tell you, when I started to write this, I did not know where this poem was going to go. Do you understand?
You wrote this in response to Hunter walking in with 13 caniches.
Yeah, I mean, he gave me the caniches, and he left me with the caniches. And, you know, all I can say is...
How many times does the word gluten appear in this
poem? Well, yeah, let's just say if you have a gluten-free diet, you'd be dead after a session with these caniches.
But, I can just see her. Keep those caniches away from me. That is disgusting.
It was disgusting, but... Here's the thing, and we're talking about poetry here, so I did not know where this was taking me. Mm-hmm. Sit down, you start to write it, and suddenly you are gone into another world, all right?
Great.
So, 13 Caniches is the title of this poem.
Okay.
Hunter brings me 13 caniches from Brighton Beach, carried them in a plastic bag on an airplane from New York all the way to L.A., assorted potato kasha. I didn't know what to say. I'm touched he thought of me that way, wanted to make me happy, the weight alone daunting, carrying onto the plane. Even if it crashed, he'd have held them tight, gone down the emergency chute, clutching them to his chest. Those caniches brought me back so many memories. Riding the bee from Manhattan to the beach, I was a teen, towel rolled tight under my arm, would stop at that dive under the L, eat one before I hit the sand, like a punch in the stomach. Even without gravy, that knish was lethal, and now I have 13. How could I tell him even the smell set me back, remembering the Israeli standing over me, blocking the sun, not a soul on the sand, my eyes closed, body slathered in copper tone. He bent down, kissed me on the lips, said, "That's what we do where I come from." I said, "This is America. I'm 16, just want a tan." It was not okay, as we say today, and I could never shake that dread, like a knish in my stomach feeling like lead. But how could Hunter have known? He brought me a gift from a place long ago, way before I knew how to say no.
That's so good.
Yeah.
That's a Hunter. You brought back. She was molested by an Israeli, by a middle-aged, hairy Israeli man.
And I brought her 13 reminders of that.
Yeah, and 13 reminders. And guess what, America? She ate all of them, and she savored them because she actually liked that Israeli guy. Kim Dower, you pervert. You gluttonous pervert. I'm so turned on, but full at the same time. That's a great poem.
Oh, there you go.
Wow.
Oh, my God.
That's a great poem.
Isn't it?
Oh, well, good. Jesus. Thank you.
Hunter, don't ever bring me any food. only Hunter, that nerd, would bring 13 caniches on a plane. I can just see him pushing it through the x-ray machine. These are my caniches. I'm bringing them for... I mean,
oh, no, Brian. Stop it.
I mean nerd in a wonderful way. He's in a good way. He's a sexy nerd. That's what I mean.
Yeah.
He's a big Dutch, big handsome Dutch nerd.
I'm doing a full calendar. Big sexy Dutch nerds.
Eating caniches.
Yeah, well, there you go.
Oh, the caniche meter just hit red hot here on the Brian Callen Show. I mean, / Hunter Motz. Hunter Knish Motz. I swear to God, that's your new nickname.
Oh, Jesus.
Hunter Knish. Listen, Brian.
Yes, ma'am.
Are you ready for another food poem?
Give it to me.
You want it?
I love food, so.
You ready?
Yes.
All right, so this is from Slice of Moon.
Oh, good.
Okay, this is the first time I'm actually reading this out loud.
And this is your book?
Yeah, my book just out, like, next week.
Okay, and it's Slice of Moon.
It's called Slice of Moon, so.
Can we get it on Amazon?
You sure can.
Okay, can you get it on Kindle?
No, you can't.
Okay, so you got to buy the actual... It's better to read poetry anyway, by the way, when you have tactile, you know,
well, let me tell you something. You can't do Kindle because they don't do line breaks. Poetry is all about line breaks.
Oh, okay, so, good. So you know what? It's the anti-technology. I appreciate it. It's immune to technology. poetry.
Yeah, there you go.
How interesting.
I don't know what you just said, but it
sounds good.
It sounded good.
Just nod your head. And,
yeah, you know. No, I like it. Something about immunity. And this poem's a little, it's a little long. It may be like a 2.5 minute poem. Is that too long?
No, come on, bring it.
All right, let's have it. It's called Guilty Pleasures.
Okay.
You like that, Brian?
I love it.
All right, this is for you. All right. My boyfriend tells me, put a candy on your naked belly. Take a picture. Send it to me. I'm far away from L.A., Helmsley Park Lane Hotel, silent on the 37th floor. White curtains opened, picture window big as a Broadway stage. Lights, not the moon, command the night. I watch them rule, slowly turn off as the buildings grow invisible, disappear into the steel sky. I spot a rooftop way below, bathed in floodlights, two chaise lounges, a table, plants. But where's the couple that should be making love in the chilly October air? Why is there so much candy in hotel rooms, all laid out like a concession stand, right there on the dresser, easy reach, take what you want, as much as you want, even if you don't want it at all, not realizing it'll cost you maybe $5 for a Snickers. Who knows how much for a Kit Kat, since they come double. Even if you take a nibble or just one Skittle, they'll charge you. Open the wrapper. It's yours. Who really even wants candy at night? I'm searching for life inside the blackness of night, watching the stained glass radiate from the top of the Chrysler Building, which appears to be floating in air. At one time, but only for 11 months, it was the tallest building in New York, until the Empire State Building took its place. When the Twin Towers were built, it was number 3. When the towers came down, number 2 again. Take a picture. I think about that Snickers on the dresser. Not that I really want it, but because it's there, I think I should have it. Because it's so quiet, I think I should keep myself awake. I lie on the bed, place a chocolate-covered almond on my naked belly, feel the party coming on. Send it to me. Suddenly it's in my mouth, another wrapper's flying. I'm having a dark chocolate fever dream as American flags below wave the night inside out.
Oh, that's great. Whoa. I'm going to have to dip myself in chocolate and come over.
There you go.
That is fantastic.
Yeah.
That's really, I mean, you're definitely the kind of gal you bring chocolates to, by the way.
I mean, not Canisius?
No, nah, yeah, I'll leave the Canisius to Hunter. You're not getting any luck. You're not getting lucky with Canisius. You're getting lucky with chocolate, obviously.
Well, anyway.
You're a very good reader, by the way.
Oh, good.
Yeah, you read your poems well, too. That's really, I mean, you're the perfect person to read those.
Oh, that's good. That all works out then.
That's great. Fellas, are you looking to spice things up in the bedroom? Been fantasizing about surprising your lover with an adventurous new toy or adult movie? Well, here's an offer you will not be able to resist. Go to adamandeve.com, and for a limited time, you'll get 50% off just about any item. But that's not all. Oh, no. Oh, no. When you select your one item at 50% off, you'll also receive 3 free adult DVDs for a little inspiration, plus a free extra gift so sensual we can't mention it on the radio. And to top it all off, we'll even throw in free shipping on your entire order. And no, we're not teasing. So check out adamandeve.com today for this special offer. Get 50% off one item when you type sideshow for the offer code upon checkout. And when you do, you'll get 3 free DVDs, a free extra gift, and free shipping. Just use offer code SIDESHOW, SIDESHOW, at adamandeve.com.
All right, so I just wanted to read that one because we're talking about, you know, guilt and candy and things like that.
Yeah, I love it.
Well, and that's the thing I really love about Kim's poetry is that, you know, you're left with something to think about. You know what I mean? And it's obviously so much of it is your own experience, but, you know, you have to go away and really meditate on the poem. And it reminds me of, like, the Buddhists used to write those, you know, short, those koans, right? And they would be these phrases or these poems. And the point was that they were an object of meditation. That
like
you would
a parable?
Yeah, and something to reflect on and something to think on. And then, you know, as you basically sharpen your mind against that across the day, you know, you emerge a better person from it.
That's what it seems to me. Everything is about refining this thing that your brain, your mind, your instincts. It's all about refining. I think that's why we go, that's why we immerse ourselves in.
Well, you know what, Brian, I have to say this to you, and I'm not kidding now, but what you just said, one of my favorite quotes of all about poetry is a great poet, and you guys should all check him out. His name is Charles Simic. He's a great poet, but his what he says about poetry is, I spend my life refining headaches, sifting them purer and purer. And refining headaches, I love
Charles Simic.
Simic, S-I-M-I-C. He's an amazing poet. And
wow, I love that. I spend my life refining headaches.
Refining headaches, sifting them purer and purer.
That's what you have to, that's kind of what... I guess everything, in a way, and certainly writing of any kind, is constant refining.
Yeah,
you know, who was it? I think it was the writer who worked with Norman Jewison on a movie, and Norman Jewison said, "This is the best script I've ever read." And Bill Moyers, whoever was doing the interview, said, "What an intro!" And then he said, "Oh yeah, that was just the beginning of 6 months of rewrites." You know, it's always refining, always getting it perfect.
Yeah.
You know? Which you obviously, how long did it take you to write those poems?
Oh, well, the second one that I read that's in this book, I must have done, I don't know, 100 drafts on it. Even if you just take out a word or two, I mean, I had the line, my boyfriend tells me put a candy on your naked belly, take a picture, send it to me. I mean, it always comes right out with that, with, you know, what I want to, that first line, and then you don't, like I say, don't really know where it's going to take you.
Yeah.
But that's a long poem. It took me many drafts to write that poem. Sometimes they really do just kind of pop out, I will say.
Yeah.
But most of them take, 40, 50 drafts.
Yeah, see, that's so encouraging. I feel less lonely now that I'm writing my script, and I don't even have the guts yet to write. I'm just outlining gently. I've spent a year thinking about it. That people are like, what? Yeah, that's how long I've spent trying to figure out exactly what I'm trying to say, and it's so daunting to kind of decide I'm going to go ahead and try to do this because it means so much to you, you know? I'm looking at a Charles Simic poem. It's called I Am the Last, and it's a very short poem. I'll read it because this cracks me up that somebody would just sit here and write this. This is just, it's downright one, it's weird and wonderfully odd, and, you know, you try to figure this out. I am the last. I am the last Napoleonic soldier. It's almost 200 years later, and I am still retreating from Moscow. The road is lined with white birch trees, and the mud comes up to my knees. The one-eyed woman wants to sell me a chicken, and I don't even have any clothes on. The Germans are going one way, I am going the other. The Russians are going still another way and waving goodbye. I am a ceremonial saber. I use it to cut my hair, which is 4 feet long. That had to have been written right after World War II, I think.
Well,
I don't know.
See, that's a beautiful poem. I love that poem, and he's great, but everything's fresh. It's things you've never seen. It's a surprise. A good poem is filled with surprise.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's what we say, you know, when is the turn in the poem? You know, the turn with, and I'm not calling myself great, but just because I read the 13 Knishes, you know, the turn comes. You think you're going one way. It's about this nice person bringing you Knishes and reminiscing and going to Brighton Beach, and suddenly you're turning into a very dark alley. And, you know, where a poem turns, like Frank O'Hara, the turn comes when he sees the New York Post. And we're with him. And so what we look for in a poem are the turns and the surprises and the energy. That's a very energetic poem you just read, that Charles Simic. It's all these images, and the mud is up to his things, and he doesn't have clothes, and the chicken. You got all these things going on in probably five lines.
Yeah.
And this is the beauty of poetry when it's good.
No question.
Kim, if you were going to say to somebody, you know, you want to begin to explore the world of poetry, what would your recommendations be? Because obviously schools provide a certain curriculum, and that hasn't served a lot of us because we're not inspired by poetry. So what would you recommend?
Oh, my goodness. Billy Collins. I would recommend Billy Collins. People start, you know, just Google Billy Collins. He's a really wonderful poet, but he's accessible. And when people say a poet is accessible, you know, critics think, well, that's not good then. You know, nonsense anyway. Critics love him. But he's accessible in that he invites you in and you're not lost. Mm-hmm. But then he shows you what a wonderful poem is. So, I mean, I love him. I love, you know, Kim Adonisio, who is an amazing poet. She lives up in the Bay Area, and she does workshops all over the country.
How do you spell her name?
Adonisio, Addonizio. She's one of my favorite poets. Oh. Also, you know, there's something for everyone. You know, there's a wonderful poet named Amy Gertzler, Gertzler. And Amy Gertzler says, she teaches poetry, and she says that when people say to her, I don't like poetry, it's like someone saying, I don't like food.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, because there's something for everyone. And, you know, we made the gluten-free jokes. Well, you may be gluten-free, you may be sonnet-free, but then there's, you know, there's another poem for you.
Yeah.
There's so much different kinds of poetry. So Jane Hirschfield, for example, she writes beautiful lyric poems. They're simple and they're more contemplative. They're not like Frank O'Hara or like my poems that tell more of a story. There's narrative poetry. So, you know, Jane Hirschfield, Kim Adonisio, Thomas Lux, L-U-X, is a great poet. These are all living, breathing people, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
you know, the ones I, and James Tate is, you, everyone should check out James Tate, T-A-T-E. Billy Collins, Stephen Dunn, D-U-N-N, is, oh my God, I just love his poetry.
Stephen Dunn?
Dunn, D-U-N-N. And these are all different, very different kinds of poets.
I'm writing all these down.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny, man. I'm bored, I'm this and that. No, you're not bored. Just if there's so much to look at and so much to read, that's the one great thing about technology and the internet. At my fingertips, I can bring all these people up. You know,
yeah,
and then take credit for it at a cocktail party.
Yeah, there you go. And you can get lost in their work too.
Yeah.
So it's better than reading Facebook.
Thank God for poets.
And I would add one more name to the great living, breathing poets, Kim Dower.
There it is, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, Hunter.
That's a good way to end this. Kim Dower. Why didn't I do that? Damn it, Hunter.
Well,
that's why you're here.
I think you've used that bit before in other things,
listen,
so I may have just stolen it and repurposed it.
Kim Dower,
but
you
I would
are,
add Kim to the list.
I would, too, after listening to those two awesome poems. And tell us the book again.
The book is called Slice of Moon.
Slice of Moon.
Slice of Moon.
And by the way, you can't get it on Kindle because it'll mess with the lines.
But I will be reading all over the country. And you can look up KimDowerPoetry.com, and you can see where I'll be reading.
Oh, great. All right, everybody. For those people, and I'll try to rubber band my underwear at you while you're reading one of them.
Oh, thank you. I would expect no less.
So you can be like a rock star.
That's
listen,
Brian's love language.
Brian, I want you to bring me something from Buffalo, okay?
Whatever you want, sister. Okay. Well, I'll go get you some of that Rocky Mountain taffy that I'm sure they have.
And some wings.
God, I can't stand whenever I go to those places. You want some taffy?
I mean,
it's homemade right here. Nah, no thanks. And a side of diabetes?
Well, you know, you guys, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much, Kim.
Kim, thanks for being on the Brian Callen parentheses, Hunter Motz. You're still in parentheses, dude.
There's
you haven't
one
broken
day
out
I'll
of
break
it.
Out. Yeah,
maybe
yeah.
One
something
day,
to
kid.
Aspire
we'll
to.
See. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you, and I'll see you soon.
Okay.
Kim
thank
Dower,
you so much,
thank
Kim.
Thank you for putting beauty in the world.
You're welcome.
All right, darling.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
It was great.
So much fun, right?
Another great podcast, meaning nothing, and it was fantastic. I hope you guys are learning something. Apparently, our numbers are slipping a little bit because people don't want to learn. But we have a good idea. Me and Hunter, we're going to have we're going to have comics on Tuesday and thinkers and people who write like Kim on Thursdays.
Yeah.
And it's making smart people funny and funny people smart. That's Hunter's invention. I didn't. I wish I could take credit for that, but I
can't take
Hunter.
Credit for that. My co-author Katie O'Brien came up with that.
Ah,
so
Katie
we're
O'Brien.
Both stealing. We're
All
both
right.
stealing
we're
from
both
the greats.
Stealing. Katie O'Brien, the beautiful
women
Katie O'Brien.
In our lives.
Katie O'Brien, man, her husband is a lucky man. I don't know who he is, but I'll tell you what. She went to Harvard, wrote a book, and she's gorgeous. And she comes up with our catchphrase. Katie O'Brien, you're all right, sister. All right. Hey, thanks, everybody. And once again, go to briancallen.com to see me, because I'll be doing stand-up everywhere. And I'm only hilarious. All right. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show. Be sure to visit briancallen.com for information about this episode as well as past and future episodes. You can follow Brian on Twitter at Brian Callen and like him on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/Brian Callen Comedy. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.